Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to episode 9 of the Joe Prano podcast. I am your host, Joe Prano, coming to you live from Chicago, Illinois. That's right, I'm here in Chicago to headline the Comedy Bar. So if you are listening to this show the weekend that it dropped, I am in Chicago. I'm at the Comedy Bar Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. So come out and check out a show and say hello. If you are not in Chicago, go to my website, joeprano.com, and check out my calendar page. See if I'm coming to a city near you, which I probably will be sometime soon. I just lined up a bunch of great dates all over the country. I'll be working with Eddie Ift on some shows. I'll be headlining myself on some shows. So go to my website and check out my shows page. Also, if you want to support this show, there's a couple ways to do it. Patreon.com/Joe Prano. Everybody that becomes a patron will get some exclusive content. I did an exclusive episode a couple weeks ago for you guys. I'm thinking about doing a weekly live chat, live video chat, so we can connect a little bit more directly. And also, you can just rate, review, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or SoundCloud or Stitcher or wherever you download the podcast from. As a show that is still less than 10 episodes old, all the ratings and reviews and subscriptions really help, especially in these early days. So if you haven't done that yet, I'd very much appreciate it if you could do that. My guest today is my manager, Randy Siegel. I got a little bit of criticism recently from a friend who said, you haven't had many female guests on yet. And that's true. In fact, the only female guest I've had is Nicole, the publicist, on the 3-part social media episode. And I hear that criticism, and I agree with it. I actually have a few female guests lined up, but just haven't gotten around to working out our schedules and recording those episodes. So I realize that we are almost 10 episodes in, and I've only had one female guest. It's not on purpose. I need to have more female guests. I'm working on it. But my first one-on-one female guest, I knew it was going to be this way for a long time, and it's happening today. Had to be with my manager, Randy. She has been so instrumental in shaping my career over the last year and a half that we've been working together that I thought it might be cool for you guys to hear about her career in the business, about how she handles working with me, how she handles working with other people. I just love Randy so much, and I think you guys are going to love her too. She has a long resume in the Hollywood industry. Most notably, as she describes it, she took Jimmy Fallon from nothing to everything, which was how she was introduced to me by somebody else. And I said, well, yes, I'm absolutely very interested in meeting with somebody that took Jimmy Fallon from nowhere to The Tonight Show, as I am currently nowhere and would like to be on a show like that. So here is my interview with Randy Siegel. I hope you guys enjoy it, and thanks for listening.
Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
I told you before I even started, well, actually not before I started the podcast, because you were very upset that I didn't tell you I had started a new podcast.
I don't even want to discuss that.
But
why do you have to bring up stuff it makes me anxious right away?
But I told you once I did tell you that I started a new podcast, I told you that I wanted to have you on as a guest, and you were immediately hesitant. You're like, what do you want to talk to me about?
Well, I talk to you every day almost.
Yeah.
Like sometimes 7 times a day.
Well, a lot of this show is about talking to other people and promoting what they're doing. This episode is all about me. I just want to talk about me.
So enough about you. So, what do you think of me?
Yeah. So enough about you manage people, blah, 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 blah,
yeah, blah, blah, blah.
One of those people is me. No, but
what are you talking about? No other people, just you, Prano.
You have a long career in the, not that long, you're very young. You have a long career in the entertainment industry. I know you don't want to do a you know, rehashing of your career highlights and lowlights, but just to catch people up to speed with how, yeah, with how we ended up eventually working together. Why don't you just give me like the briefest run through of your time in entertainment industry, how it started and where you got to where you are today.
This is the credibility part.
This is the credibility part. Just so that when people go, this is your manager? And I'm like, I was working at a Burger King and Joe walked in and he was
like,
doing
jokes.
You
need a manager. You look like you're funny.
I manage this place. Sales have doubled.
Fries are through the roof. Yes, I have had a long career in the comedy business. I currently am a manager. I started out, blah-bitty-blah blah, years ago, as a receptionist for a man named Bernie Brillstein, who, for those people listening, in the entertainment world, Bernie was one of the biggest comedy producer managers in the business. He had everybody on SNL, Lorne Michaels from the beginning, and quite a legend. He passed away 10 years ago. But I started as his receptionist pretty much right out of college. And I was such an amazing receptionist, apparently, that I got a raise after the first week.
1 week in and you got
a
raise?
1 week I got a raise.
That's amazing. I've never actually gotten a raise at any job I've ever held. So you got one after 1 week.
After 1 week. I was that good. But no, what it goes to is, you know, any job that you do, you should do it as best as you possibly can. And I did that. And then I was tired of being a receptionist. I was like, I got a college degree. I'm answering phones. But I was a receptionist for maybe 9 months. And then I got promoted to being an assistant. And it was actually for a guy that they had brought in from another management company who had more dramatic clients, actually, which I was like, great, I get the drama guy. But he had like film directors, he had Nicolas Cage and Christopher Lambert, and he was a very nice guy. He actually unfortunately has passed away too. Good Lord.
I'm starting to worry about myself now. Have you worked with anybody that is still alive?
Well, there's a pretty big track record of ones that are dead. So yeah. But the point being, I got on his desk and he wasn't exactly the teaching type guy, you know? So I had to really pull teeth to be like, hey, I wanted to learn this. And I would ask about contracts and he reluctantly would teach me. But anyway, the girl whose desk was next to mine, her boss was this guy named Ray, and he had like 90% of the SNL. Rob Schneider, David Spade, Adam Sandler.
So this is, I mean, you're now, you didn't want to say when, but this now you're dating yourself.
It's in the early
90s. It's in the 90s, yeah.
Hang on, yeah, in the early 90s when I was like, you know, 16. We'll just say that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got out of college really early. No one's going to believe that. But anyway, so yeah, it was the
well,
early
you got 90s. You got a raise after a week and you got a promotion after 9 months. So maybe you finished college at 15.
I moved quickly. So when his assistant though would be gone, I would cover her desk. So, I always had more fun covering his office than the one I was in. And then when she quit, instead of them hiring someone else, I went to him and I said, you know, can I switch? And I did. And that was literally like falling into what was then going to become my life. The comedy world where, you know, I just don't believe that you choose it. It chooses you. And for some reason, there I was and there it was. And Spade, Schneider, Sandler, those guys were all like becoming regulars.
And that was a time when SNL was really still one of the huge shows on television. Like everybody who gets on SNL and then starts working and getting sketches and, you know, actually being on the show kind of turned into rock stars. Like
yes.
Everybody.
Yes.
You either didn't make the cut or you became a movie star.
Yes.
So that's like a couple of years where those guys are going from nobodies to everything.
Right. Well, that's also because during that time, they were starting to make movies out of sketches. So Wayne's World was happening. You know, Sandler started doing movies and it all kind of started. So
don't forget Night at the Roxbury.
Well, of course. I've got the head bobbing in my head.
Yeah.
That was great. But yeah, it was kind of like this really unique time. And, you know, the guys like Tim Meadows, you know, Fred Wolf, you know, and all the writers. I mean, this was like a heyday happening. Chris Farley, and just so much excitement. And keep in mind, the comedy business itself was on this boom as well, because that's when stand-ups were starting to get their own shows. And it was the big thing to do. If you were a stand-up, you wanted your own show. And it was happening. So the Seinfeld era, the Brett Butler had her own show. You know, there was a formula to some of this, that if you were a stand-up who had been on the road for 15, 20 years, you had a shot at a show. But it was the brass ring. So learning all of it was, you know, fascinating. And I would start going to the comedy clubs at night and hang. I would literally like just follow my boss around, and to the point that it was like, can you please leave me alone? But I used to sit at the back of the clubs and just watch and listen and learn.
And what's in LA at that time, what is the scene in the comedy clubs? How does it compare to what's happening today?
Oh my God. I think back then you could still smoke in the club, by the way. So picture this. Yeah. It's a smoky club. And that's
smoky
actually kind
club,
of what it is.
Rob Schneider walks in.
Exactly. So let's go to black and white. Okay. And yeah, it was, everybody hung out. So you had, keep in mind, this is before internet.
Right.
Before, I mean, we still, everyone's
cell phone cameras, cell phones, even cell phones. No,
yeah. Cell phones were just coming around. You know, this was 90.
And you were a Hollywood power player. So you probably had
the gigantic one
with a battery pack.
When a car phone meant it was literally attached to the car. But it was that era where, everybody went to the clubs. So you have,
who is like in that time, who's the biggest thing that could, or biggest person that could drop into the club?
Oh, president of a network. I mean, you literally had presidents, EVPs, decision makers from studios and networks were out at the clubs watching people. And what it became was this.
Is that simply just because it wasn't, we get a tape from the club and send it, or like, get, you know, just send me a link. They had to be there to.
There was no link back
right.
then.
Right. And I, obviously.
Yeah. there were no links.
Hold your cell phone up to the stage.
Yeah. There were
Park no your links. Car by the stage and hold your car phone up. I need to know what Pryor's up to.
It was VHS tapes. For anyone who's listening that doesn't know what that is.
Yeah.
You may be too young for the rest of the content of this episode because it's going to get dark. But no, it was about getting tape, and you had to have, you know, and you would edit like reel to reel. I mean, this was the days where people went out, they had to see it. And it's about it. I think what's so great about having been in it at that time, even though I think I've been in show business 20 years too late, I still feel like I've got that older soul, mm-hmm. like I should have been around a long time ago. But that generation was, you packed that room. If it was a showcase, like if you had a client that you were trying to get a deal for, you would pack that room, and it was wall to wall. You couldn't even get in the door sometimes. Standing room only. You'd have every competing studio's executive there. You'd have writers there. And it was literally like the moment that you could create the buzz.
So what's your specific role on a night at the comedy club where one of your clients is showcasing?
Well, back then, when I was still a young assistant, what was interesting from that perspective was all the pressure wasn't on me, you know, if it was a client or something. But the learning process was really interesting because, you know, again, comedy is so subjective, and I could look at a room and see, you know, somebody bombing, but yet they get called in on 6 auditions the next day, you know, and end up getting a gig. And you got other comics that are like, what the fuck, you know, I killed and this guy. So understanding why that happens.
How times have changed.
It's still the same shit. Now it's just, oh, by the way, what's your Twitter following?
Yeah.
That is the deciding factor now. But I think that people who wonder, should I do comedy? I'm thinking about being a stand-up. Should I do it? If ever I'm asked that question, the answer is immediately no. And, you know, I'll have people ask it and I'll say, no, but you don't even know what I do. It doesn't matter. The fact that you had to ask me means you don't want to do it. Because I fully believe, and this comes from having been super young and in the clubs and in that generation and watching it, watching comics, you know, struggling with their own, you know, self-worth or struggling with their own desire to get on stage night after night after night. And it is, it's like a drug. It's like watching somebody who can't shake, you know, a really bad habit. And then when you add the habits that they did have on top of it.
Right. Like, well, it's like you said about yourself, like the comedy life chose you. Yeah. That's the same thing with me. Is I never said I want to be a stand-up comic. I just thought, oh, I'll do stand-up to, you know, learn stage presence and get a little better at public speaking. And I want to do TV. So Letterman worked at the Comedy Store. I should just go to the comic strip and right. try out and see if I can. And the next thing I know, here I am, you know, like, God, I still don't want to be in this, but
you're doing
it's
it.
My life.
Yeah.
You know, it chose me. And when you're at those shows back then and you're watching all of these people, like, how many of them were you like, oh, that guy's never going to be anything, and he became a movie star, as opposed to, like, were there people that you were like, this guy's brilliant, and now they're long gone? You never know.
Yes. But what used to be interesting for me was there were these two women, Joy Dolce and Claudia Kagan. Actually, I haven't talked to Joy in a long time. I'm not sure where she is.
Old Dolce and Kagan.
Old Dolce and Kagan. Claudia is a producer at Entertainment Tonight currently. She and Joy used to cast comics or book comics for the first incarnation of the Arsenio Hall show.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And because I worked at Brillstein and, you know, worked with all the managers that they, you know, had great relationships with. And they, I think, kind of liked the fact that I was so ambitious and I was just like, I want to learn. So I would get to sit at the back of the clubs with them and watch their showcases, because they would do, you know, 15, 20 comics to showcase to get on Arsenio. And I would start to guess. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to guess. You like that guy, this chick, da, da, da. And they'd be like, nope, 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 and maybe yes. And I'm like, geez, how did I get it all wrong? And the thing is, it's not just about, do you think somebody's funny or what is the it factor or what star power? There's a method to TV sets. And this phrase that used to be thrown around a lot that I never understood until much later on was, are they TV ready? And what it comes back around to is, you know how I talk to you about standing still?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you pace a lot. You can't just be pacing if you're doing a late night spot.
Right.
You know, it's like there are some comics, yes, that are very animated and it's part of what they do. But for the most part, there's an X on the floor, stand on your mark, do your set, and everybody goes home happy, hopefully. If you can't show that in a showcase, they're not going to see you as ready to do the show. They want to know that your material and your stage presence is ready to go. Like, great, let's book this guy. We can get him on tomorrow. If that's not there, and if all those components aren't there.
That's just because the union guys are like, you don't pay me enough to follow him back and forth.
I'm stationary.
If you can't stay on the X, you can't book him.
That's true. But it's about being TV ready. And that is also why I talk a lot about stage presence and stuff like that. But those things you only learn from experience and from sitting around and doing it. And yeah, I used to keep my own notebooks of who I think was going to make it or not. But if you want to talk about who I thought would make it or not, when I was at National Lampoon back in 2001, I did a showcase for the CEO of the company of all these comics that I thought we should be paying attention to and should
you
get into
chose
business
them. With. Yep. This was your lineup.
This was me. I got brought in as the head of talent development.
All dead now.
They're dead. I got brought in as the head of talent development and I said, let me put together a showcase and show you who I think. So on that roster was Mark Maron, Zach Galifianakis, Nick Swardson, Alan Covert. They were all on it. Bonnie McFarlane.
So just a big swing and a miss by you, Siegel.
I know. I have zero taste.
Yeah.
And that's the type of thing that I get excited about was, you know, people that I like that I thought, you know, would be great to be in business with. And they're all super successful, which is great. I love all those guys.
Yeah. So you just talked about being at National Lampoon in 2001.
Yeah.
Fill in the blank quickly, because you're an assistant in the back of a smoky comedy club.
Yes.
Now you have put together a super lineup of comedians in 2001.
Yeah. So what's in between? If I told you,
yada yada yada,
yada yada yada, and now I'm booking talent. No, but let's not forget, though, the assistant days and dealing with what we now know as Me Too moments. You know? Oh, please. The story's Prano. Talk about it. Yeah, it's just...
Are they all in your notebooks?
They're all in my notebook. They're going to be in
there. You have one specific notebook for all those, or does that just get mixed in? And Zach Galifianakis, kind of pudgy, but I really like his stage presence. Club owner grabs his ass. Marin, I don't know, seems angry. Something dear, about him, though.
Dear Diary. Mark Maron seems angry. P.S. Somebody grabbed my ass. no, but it was bad. It's definitely... It's the comedy business, what a lot of people don't realize, and I know that a lot of your audience are comics or in the business, and everybody has their own point of view because either you're a performer and you see it from one side, or you're someone who's doing business, you see it from another. But the real comedy... scene is super dark. I mean, you could be sitting in a club for hours on end. You watch comics that go up. They, either do great or don't do great. It's their battles with themselves. Sometimes it just is a late night and there's a lot that's just going on, but it's a rough scene and guys are really vulgar.
It all happens in a place. It all happens at night.
Yep.
It all happens around alcohol.
Yep.
It all happens with a bit of testosterone and competition and there's jockeying for position and jockeying to get in front of people and that. So it's a very cutthroat world that you then combine with, again, booze and drugs. And I feel like, I know comedy's getting sort of called out right now, but I'm sure the guy who's club promoting, it's a similar, it's a similar vibe, or a bar, the bartending world or whatever. Like, I feel like this is all happening in the same scene, right?
Yeah.
Do you think comedy's especially, I know this has been your bag for a while now, but do you think it's especially dark as compared to just entertainment in general?
Yes. Did I say that too fast?
Not only did you say it too fast, you were looking off into the distance, thinking about some horrible incident. Yes. Let's talk about it again. How did you become a manager, and then who were you managing?
You're like, can we please get back to the late 90s?
If we don't get to you being a manager, we can't talk about me. God damn it, we're half hour into this.
We're
we haven't talked to me
93.
At all. I keep having to bring myself up.
No, after 5 years at Brillstein, and I had my own clients, but I wasn't officially bumped up, and I had a couple offers to go elsewhere, and I did take one of those offers, and there was a guy who was the office manager at this company, gave me a tape from a kid that he knew in upstate New York and said, this kid, he's really talented. He wants to be on Saturday Night Live. Since you're coming over here to do a comedy division, thought you might take a look at him. And it was, Jimmy Fallon, who it was a set, I don't know, he was 17 doing a set at Bananas in Poughkeepsie, and super talented. I think that tape's been around now, but obvious talent. And
yeah, after you sold it to A&E.
Damn it. It's nothing that's sacred.
That's how you bought the Siegel Lair.
Does manager-client confidentiality not mean anything to you? It works both ways.
When they see the drone shot of your super mansion in Calabasas, they're going to need an explanation.
Exactly. Yeah. The explanation is CGI.
So you had just gone over to an agent. You're going to run the comedy department.
Yep. So, and
somebody,
I signed Jimmy.
Somebody just says, check out this tape.
What was the guy at that company?
Yeah, but he just says, hey,
yeah,
this
he
got
knew Jimmy
sent
from
up.
Upstate New York.
Oh, okay. So he had a relationship
he
with
knew,
him.
Yeah. So this guy named Pete Islin, he actually used to run a paper in upstate New York, a little small town paper.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy was an intern there. And when Pete shut down the paper, he wanted to come to LA to get into music management. And Jimmy said, oh, well, here's my tape if you can ever do anything for me.
Wow.
So that's literally how that happened. And I started working with Jimmy.
Well, tell me, because you, when we started working together, and we'll get to there eventually, obviously, but like the, you know, you came up to me right after a set. Was your initial reaction, you saw that tape and you're like, yes, like you knew something, or you were just like, well, kid's hungry and this guy's asking me to help? Or did you see something in that tape where you were like, I've been in the clubs, I've seen a lot of things, this guy's got something special?
Yeah, it was that. Because at that point, too, I had now spent 5 years knee deep in the Saturday Night Live business. Because as I was learning and growing, Sandler, Spade, Schneider especially were becoming serious, you know, regulars on SNL. Their movies were happening, college gigs. I started getting all that responsibility, especially with Sandler. So I ended up becoming the script supervisor on his first album, and then I did two more albums. So I ended up just knee deep in that world and got to know all, you know.
I just imagine like reading the script of The Goat and all these like ridiculous, like what are you, you're just going, well, I guess if he thinks this is going to be funny.
Well, you want to know what's funny is my first job on his album was, wait, did I do Pauly's first? I was the pre and post script supervisor for Pauly Shore's album. I'm trying to remember if I did Pauly's before Adams or Adams before Pauly. I don't remember now. It might have been Pauly's, because then the same producer, Brooks Arthur, who's now the music supervisor for Happy Madison, which is, you know, Adams' mm-hmm. production company, Brooks did Pauly's album. I think he hired me on that and then brought me into Sandler's, I think. Either way, my first job working with Adams' first album was kind of in the context, though, of being his manager's assistant. And I was coordinating all the efforts between the record label and, you know, recording sessions. And the thing is, and people who, you know, may be listening that aren't in the entertainment business or whatever, just lessons of diligence, you know, I never did a job just average. I always was like, okay, how can I do this better? How can I do this bigger? Where can I foresee, you know, that this is going to be something that's needed and I'll get it done before somebody needs it done? And there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot to be said for the assistant who is on their feet, you know, thinks, you know, fast, solves problems and makes your life easier. That's what any assistant is supposed to do. Anyone who's applying to be a secretary or an assistant or any job that's not the top position, ultimately your job is to make the person's job above you easier. That's the best thing that you can say in an interview too, is I will make your life easier. You know, hire me. You don't have to worry at the end of the day if it's getting done or not. So because I was also just so interested in learning about comedy and the business, everything fascinated me. Contracts fascinated me. Deal making fascinated me. I had the massive luck to be able to listen in on phone calls with Bernie Brillstein and Lorne Michaels and making deals for the guys with SNL and Sandy Wernick, who's still a manager, who's still Sandler's manager, listening to them negotiate. It was a unique time. So I got knee deep in it, and the script supervising gig, I think it was the second album. I'm pretty sure it was the second one. My job was to not only be at all of the recording sessions, which, by the way, fun fact, I'm actually on one of the tracks on one of the albums, FYI.
Putting it out there to the to the listeners.
It's a very
try to figure out which one, which track Siegel's
let's not
on.
Let's not try. But I would be at every recording session, and then, and the, again, this is before all of this software. Okay, This is when it was actual tape recordings, so, and CDs. So I would get all of the recordings from the day, and I would literally put them in a dictaphone, and I would transcribe by hand every single take of every single sketch from that album. So I have a printout. Have I shown it to you?
No.
I think I've told you about it though, right? It's like about 4 inches thick.
I think
it's
every
like
time you
book.
Said dictaphone, I was like, I gotta go. This isn't, I know. We can't, it's 2018. We can't even be talking about dictaphones.
Perhaps it was me when I emphasized dictaphone. So It's about 4 inches thick. I'm thinking.
Right when I drink my beer.
As I'm making the hand gesture, yeah, by the way. But yeah, every single take. I think the goat is on that one. There's sketches that never made it into the album. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have everything. And I keep forgetting to have the guys sign it. Like, I need to have everybody sign it. But point is, so I did all that stuff and was knee deep. So then by the time I was leaving and I met and I saw this tape on Jimmy Fallon, his only dream was to be on Saturday Night Live. I literally was just
What's the
in
tape?
That world.
Is he playing the guitar? Is he doing impressions? Is it all that stuff that you see sort of early Jimmy Fallon doing?
Yeah, it was. He didn't have a lot of material. So his whole set was basically impressions and musical impressions. Very little, just straight up material, you know? But he used a troll doll.
Right.
I'm sure by now everybody knows about the troll doll.
Yeah.
Back then, he was, the prop comic and the guitar guy that ultimately nobody wanted to follow. But yes, I watched it and I was like, definitely something special to this kid. He only wanted to be on SNL. That was my whole world. And he was excited to work with me because I knew Adam Sandler. That was his qualifier. Well, you know Adam Sandler, so you're going to get me on Saturday Night Live. I was like, well, all right. Okay. And
it's funny. That's the only reason I work with you either.
I know. Whatever.
It's just Sandler.
I know. But what's funny is the day that Jimmy landed in LA, I had to be at the recording studio for Sandler's album. And I said to Jimmy, I said, well, do you just want to come with me? And he was kind of like, yeah, okay. Like, it didn't occur to him what I had just said and where we were going. And so I took him with me, walking in the studio. It's like, there's Sandler. And I think maybe Norm Macdonald may have been there doing a guest thing. And I think Spade might have been there. Like, and Jimmy was just like, what just happened? Like, this is a kid who just got off a plane from upstate New York, like left college. He still had a quarter left to graduate and lands in LA and finds himself sitting in a room with every single one of his heroes. And I'm just like, yeah, I got work to do. Just sit there and watch. And it was like, what is happening?
So it's honestly just like perfect timing for everybody. Yeah. You're going out on your own. You had just worked with all these people. You're still working with all these people. And he's little Adam Sandler Jr. He just wants to be on SNL. He's got guitar. Boom.
Yeah. I mean, and people compared him to Adam too.
Sure.
But I actually, when I went to this company, it only lasted like 7 months or something. It just ended up being a bad fit. So I left there and then Jimmy followed shortly after. And, you know, all my clients came with me and I was on my own. So I found myself on my own and 2 years later, still
just
working for myself.
Just listening to White Snake in your car a lot.
Here I go again.
White Snake. But, you know, back then too, there was no internet. There was no, you know, I mean, the email. Yeah, there was email, but it wasn't, you had dial up AOL, mm-hmm. You know, there was no
watching.
Well,
you still have dial up
AOL. I do not have dial up because AOL got rid of it, but I do still have AOL. You know what? You can laugh all you want.
You've got texts. You've got tweets.
Laugh all you want, but you know what? AOL is not getting hacked as much as Gmail, so. Yeah. Joke's on you. Me and my BlackBerry and my AOL.
I should forward everything back over to my Batman account.
Netscape. But yeah, so what was I saying? Okay, so I was on my own and he got SNL while I was working on my own. And then I joined another firm that was a merger between two companies. I joined there to start a comedy division. And I was there for 2 years. And that put me at about 10 years worth of managing. And I was done. It was like being married to 8 guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also developing more of a creative brain. So I kind of was turning into a producer. So notes on scripts and wanting to be more involved on that side was far more where I was headed. And, you know, when you're a rep, you can, especially being a manager, your job is to advise. And if I got, let's say you gave me a script, mm-hmm. and I gave you notes on it, you can take those notes or not, obviously. But if you want me to start sending it out, you say, yeah, I'm not going to make the changes. Just send it out to people. I kind of got to send it out to people, you know, right. Unless I say to you, no, I'm refusing to do it, which of course is not what you're supposed to do as a rep. So I found that to be a little bit inhibiting of, you know, I know that this could be so much better. Or I know what they're looking for. That then became for me, I wanted to be more involved creatively, which a lot of managers can be producers, by the way. But at the same time that that was happening to me.
Which I only learned in working with you, yeah. Which was that managers can be producers, but agents can't.
Correct.
But it does seem like agencies now, it's like they're kind of producers, but it's, they get around the red tape.
The line in the sand is very sketchy. I mean, the waters have been muddied now because what's happened with the agency world is a lot of financiers and now they're conglomerates that have branding departments and production departments. It's not as clear a line, but for all intents and purposes, and for anyone who's interested in this stuff, the business of representation and the Hollywood business is supposed to be very clear. Agents have to be licensed and their job is to seek and secure employment. That's their job. Look for the auditions, look for the work, look for the meetings, set you up, and then hopefully you do your part, you get a job offer. A manager, by law, cannot seek and secure employment. So if a manager is representing somebody that doesn't have an agent, and there's opportunities, like to go in for auditions or something, technically, a manager can't submit you. Technically, a manager can't call up and send you in. They do it all the time, though, because what are you going to do? Not get the opportunity for your client?
Right.
Where that comes into a problem is when you're dealing with talent that may down the road decide that they don't want to pay their manager a commission anymore for whatever reason. And they could say, well, you know what? You weren't supposed to get me the job in the first place. So then if you're really not a nice person, you invoke what's called the Talent Agencies Act, which is an act that protects agents and defines what it is to be a representative. And they say, well, you violated the Talent Agencies Act when you sent me in on that audition. And even though I've been on this series for 3 years that you did the deal for, you got me in on, right. And I've been paying you all this time, I don't want to pay you anymore. And they can actually just hide behind that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of lawsuits that have come out of it from people that have tried doing that. There's a lot around it in the courts. That's a whole other thing to get into. But agents are licensed. They take 10%, can't by law take any more. Managers, their job is to advise and strategize and hopefully work with the rest of the team. Managers kind of like your CEO. And we'll coordinate then the lawyer, the business manager, the publicist. So when you're,
before you get out of management and you start getting into the other side, how many clients are you working with?
I had specifically 8.
And then how many of those are like, have the same lawyer, have the same agent, are you pretty much working with the same people all the time, or are there 8 people going in 8 different directions?
It depends. I mean, sometimes you're just going to find, you know, that you've got 3 clients at CAA, which is fine. I mean, by the way, 8 clients was not a lot. There's some managers who have 20, which is a lot, but you're never going to be what an agent has. An agent could be working with hundreds of clients at a time. But ultimately, I have a very specific philosophy about putting together someone's team. Okay. So as your manager, if you know, when you get to a point where you need a lawyer, I'm not just going to say to you, here's a guy. Okay. I'm going to tell you, here's 3 that I like. And I'll tell you why I like them.
Right. I specifically need a defense attorney.
Well, it's a whole other thing for you. I'm sorry. I don't know you anymore. Joe Prano. I don't know that guy. Unbelievable. So I would present you with people because ultimately it's your decision. You have to like these people. Even though I'm the one that's going to be talking to them mostly, it's your relationship. And I think that this is one thing that talent, whoever's talent out there that listens to you or people who are reps or whatever, you have to always remember who works for who works side by side with who, and whose agenda are people looking out for, okay? As a manager, my agenda is supposed to be specifically for my client. Nothing else matters. Not my own agenda. I shouldn't have my own agenda. Okay. An agency, especially big ones, yes, their job is to look out for you, but they may have a bigger agenda because they may also represent the producer. They may also have a deal with the studio. They may have other things, you know, that is like, I got to worry about this. I don't want to piss off so-and-so by pushing this project. Lawyers, their job is 100% to focus on your deal and your deal alone. But they're also not going to really step in ahead of time. They're, when you have a deal, let me know.
Right.
I look at the paperwork, we'll make you the best deal. So there's also a sense of, you know, when do you need the publicist? When, you know, I mean, you know, we're going to need that when you start getting in trouble.
Right.
But, you know, spin control, all of that stuff. So a manager used to take 15% for that. The standard used to be 15 in the 90s. And the theory was, well, a manager does 15% of the work. They should get 15% of the cut. Okay. But then when lawyers were coming into play a little bit more so, because a lot of times the big agencies have business affairs departments and they can handle the contracts. But sometimes you need to bring in your independent lawyer. Lawyers will take 5%. The ones that work on a project contingency.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're paying 10 to an agent, 15 to a manager, and 5 to a lawyer, it's a lot of money going out the door. So what managers started kind of doing a little bit was releasing that 5% to go to the lawyer, and then you weren't putting out an additional 5.
Right.
But what they were also doing is managers were getting competitive and being smart about it to try to sign somebody. Say, well, you know what? I tell you what, I'll take 10 instead of 15. So it was a signing tactic. So management just kind of started dropping to 10. Nothing regulates managers. So if I'm a manager, I could have come up to you and said, well, here's my deal, Joe. I take 22.5%, you know, and you'd be like, all right. Like, if you agree, then yay me. You know what I mean? But it's not regulated. So it's typically 10% though. But a manager's job is much more invested than an agent.
Right.
Like an agent won't go and watch you do set after set after set and work with you on your material. They're just not going to do it. They'll be like, let me know when he's ready.
And when you had eight, when you had a roster of eight, were those comedians? All comedians?
Yeah. All comedy people.
And so you're having, because we work together on my set all the time. You come to shows all the time.
Yes.
So you were just going
all the time.
Every day. Just
every night.
Sets.
Sometimes two in a row. Sometimes. Yeah.
Here's a question for you, because eight's not a huge number, but it's big enough. How often were there like jokes or material that were like bleed? You're like, you know what? You guys should talk about this.
Very rarely.
Because you had a wide array of styles and types of people, or just because?
Yeah, and because also everyone had different goals.
Look, you seven, troll dolls are off the table. No troll dolls for you guys. No dolls at all, honestly.
By the way, instead of a guitar, can you do a ukulele?
Yeah. Here's a pile of stuff. He's taking the troll and the guitar. You guys, what do you want, the kazoo?
Well, the thing is, everybody also was at different stages. You know, by that time, he's on SNL.
Right.
And his goals are different, and everything that's happening for him is different. Mitch Mullaney, who, dead. Good Lord. Man, I miss Mitch. Mitch was awesome. He had come off of a series, and we actually ended up with another development deal for him to develop a series. So he wasn't in as much need with working on his material. He was pretty much, you know, a veteran guy. And there was just other stuff that the attention was on with him, finding writers, finding showrunners, you know, that stuff. The majority, I think, of work that you're talking about, I had maybe like three comics that were in those stages of really needing development.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so very different that there was never, and a couple of them were buddies.
And is that something that you, as a manager, think about when you're looking at people like, oh, he's funny, but I already have someone like him?
Well, again, management, you can be more selective. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't sign two people that are so similar, you know. Not only would I not want to have that issue, but...
Like guys walk on stage now, devastatingly handsome, mustache. You're like, that's all stocked up on my roster.
I'm like, I got that already.
I already got that.
I got that at home. yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean, what it really comes down to is... It's a volume business for agents sometimes, because it's more based on auditions okay? And if there's a breakdown that comes out for a role that they need, you know, a 37-year-old, you know, tall, handsome, funny guy, they got a list of 100 people to submit.
Right.
You know? I'm focused on what is right for my one guy, you know? And for me, I have never worked with anyone that I didn't watch or see something on and go, okay, I got to see that again. Or what else you got? That's where my success has come in. I mean, I have worked with people that I didn't necessarily feel that way, but I kind of was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot and what have you. And I was wrong.
Because those people approached you, they knew about you, or somebody told you you should. How do you get yourself in that situation? Because if you're sort of going with your gut, then what? How do you find yourself?
If somebody comes to you and is like, I really want you to come see me and I really want to work with you, and I'm kind of a sucker for like nice people, you know, because not everyone is. But if I feel like there's something there, there's some potential, you know, there's been just a couple of times over the years where I've jumped in and I was like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work, but it still is one of those things where you have to trust your gut. And you're, by the way, that means jumping in and jumping out.
Right.
You got, Bernie Brillstein used to have a saying that the minute you get this feeling in your gut, when you hear that person's name, if you get a bad feeling, you got to end it. It's over. It's time to go. And he's right, by the way. He was very right about that.
That's like dating advice too.
Oh, hell yeah. Is that going to be the second half of this?
Yeah. It's like, well, as a client, they can still make me money even if I hate them, but.
That is true. That's very true. That's where it gets hard, because the money factor is very deceiving. And what it also is, and as you know, it's always about the potential. You know, it's like, oh, if I could just get this one thing, if I could just get this one thing. And a friend of mine, this is before I was working with you. You know what? It actually might have been when I was thinking about signing you. And I was talking to a friend of mine who I had literally had a conversation with saying, I need to get out of management. And I've told this to you. This isn't like news to you. Suddenly I'm breaking it to you. I don't want to be a manager anymore. I didn't want to be doing it.
I want to dance. What the fuck's happening?
Cue the music. And I said to a friend, but I saw this guy, Prano. And he says, do you understand? And by the way, there's a friend who's not in show business. Okay. Do you understand that you sound like a drug addict? I'm like, I don't know what you mean, as I'm like smacking my arm. I'm like, what? He says, you are like waiting for your next fix. That's what you sound like. You're like, oh, but then I saw, and I just know it can happen here. And I just, oh, now it's like a drug. You are an addict. You are addicted to your business. You're addicted to the possibilities. You're addicted to the idea that it's just going to be one more. It's just going to be this next one. I was like, so what's wrong with that?
Right.
Isn't that what we all do?
But you got to a point where you said, you want to switch over, you want to cross over to the other side. And then you did. And we've talked a lot about you know, it's always like, I can't keep up with the timeline, but there, you know, there was National Lampoon, MySpace. You were doing things where you weren't managing people and you were on the, you know, creative side.
Right.
How do you come back? Were you like, I miss it? Or you're like, I'm just not working out on the creative side now? Or I want to give notes again.
No, you know what? It was always the just happenstance. So when I left management, that was a very clear decision. I was out. In fact, I wanted out of show business because it had gotten to a point when you achieve a certain level of success, you become a bigger target and it gets more and more cutthroat. And I think that there are times where if I had just played ball a certain way or done things that I would have had to compromise a few morals and ethics, I could be running a studio right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I chose not to do certain things. I chose to go the other way from certain things. And I was taken advantage of a few times by that. I didn't see it coming sometimes. I'd be like, God damn it, how'd that happen? And it's kind of like getting stabbed in the back while they're looking at you right in the face. Mm-hmm. It's like, what the fuck? Does that have your name on the handle? That is crazy. So I got to a point where I was 32 and I was flash forwarding my life 10 years and thinking, if I'm still doing this and still in this grind and dealing with these people, not my clients, but the industry itself, in 10 years, I don't know that I'm going to survive. And I quit. Like, I just quit. No one believed me, by the way, that I wasn't going to another management.
How company. Many clients did you leave without
like
a manager?
Like eight. I mean, the company still kept them, right. You know, but people didn't believe that I was just leaving the business. They were like, come on, you got to tell me, where are you going? I'm like, nowhere. I'm going to my couch.
Where did you go?
I should have gone into a loony bin. But I ended up, it's actually, you'll appreciate this. I think I told you I did this. I decided I want to try to work for the NFL.
Okay.
You know, because I'm a huge NFL fan.
Yep.
So I was like, fuck it, I'm going to go work for the NFL. And I wrote a letter to the vice president, to Jim Steig, and I got a note back on NFL stationery. It's framed. It's official NFL letterhead that basically said, thank you, but no thank you. I was like, damn it. But I ended up getting introduced to this guy named Dan Lakin, who was taking over National Lampoon. And Dan was this guy from Indiana who was not from the entertainment business, had put together a finance group to take over the brand. And I was like, well, okay, guy who doesn't know comedy, he's taking over the Lampoon, wants to revamp it. So I sat down with him. Great guy. At the end of the lunch, I was like, so let me get this straight. You have a son who reads your scripts. You think Richard Pryor is still on tour. You watch no television and you're trying to take over the biggest brand name in comedy. He's like, yep. I'm like, you need me. And then I campaigned him for a while, but I got hired. And that was the EVP of talent job, where the first showcase I did for him had all those great comics on it. But I was there for about five or six years. And then I had an opportunity to go work for Comic Relief, mm-hmm. the 2006 Comic Relief. And I went and did that. I was going to stay with Comic Relief and hopefully now do some more, branch it out from just the shows.
Is Comic Relief still a thing?
It is, but Bob Zemuda, who owned Comic Relief, who created it, I believe he sold the name now.
Because for a time, it was the biggest thing for people who don't know, for younger listeners. It was the face of Comic Relief was Billy Crystal, Robin Williams, Whoopi Goldberg, and they would basically do wasn't a telethon, but it was a night of
comedy
and performance to support like homelessness, I think it was.
Homelessness,
right?
And
but it was the biggest thing. That was like when I was growing up, I you would go like Comic Relief, oh, like I'm just going to learn about everybody. And then you can follow that, you go, oh, that person's really funny.
There's pretty much not a comic that hasn't been through Comic Relief. And some of the best footage on these guys, like Dane Cook, like as a baby doing comedy, you know, like some of these guys' first TV sets were Comic Relief. And when I went to work for them, I mean, I had access to all the archives. Fascinating. It was just so much fun going through all of it. But that one in particular was for Hurricane Katrina Relief. Mm-hmm. And then I was there waiting for, so Bob Zemuda was off in Thailand helping the elephants. And I'm like, oh, when are we going to do something? And a friend of mine named Dan Pasternak, who's a producer, called me up and said, Fred Silverman is looking to start his production company again and he needs an executive. So Fred Silverman was one of the only programming executives who ran ABC, CBS, and NBC. He's from the 70s. 70s through those decades. Half the history of television was under Fred's mm-hmm. regime. And, so Dan was like, do you want to go meet him? I'm like, I'll meet him to be his gardener. Are you kidding? Right. Like, it's Fred Silverman. Of course I'll go for the meeting. So I went for the meeting, and it was actually a pretty funny meeting because Fred was 70 and just had a very, different perspective on the business. And he asked me in the meeting, he said, do you have a list of references? You know, it's like anyone who's ever applied for a job, you know, you always put references available on request.
Yeah.
And then if they ever ask, you quickly get a fucking list together and you call a few people and say, hey, will you say nice things about me?
Yeah.
Okay. So I go, yes, I do. And he just pauses and he's just sitting there staring at me. And I go, do you want it now? And he's like, I just asked you for it, didn't I? And I was like, oh shit. So, cause he was a very gruff man, but it's like, oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. I can get you that. You know, I didn't bring it with me. Don't walk around with it in my pocket, you know, like, here you go.
All your references should be somebody whose number you know by heart.
Exactly.
Oh, shit.
Let me get your rotary phone and we'll dial them up.
1-877 Cars for Kids. They know me over there. They have good things to say.
So I gave him that and he hired me the next day. And it was one of those things that you go into, say, and... By the way, this is not stuff that's out of school. There's a lot that's written about Fred. There are mm-hmm. stories about Fred. He's portrayed in the Late Night Wars movie, not in the greatest light. My mentor, Bernie Brillstein, who I never made a move without consulting him, he was a reference for me. He was one of my references.
Yeah.
And he said, you know.
You're like, how about Bernie Brillstein? You fucking heard of him?
Exactly.
Do you have his number, Fred?
So... Bernie said...
By the way, he's bernie@AOL.com. So just...
He said, you know, he's known to be pretty rough. He said, but, you know, you got to respect what he's done. And again, a lesson in you may not like certain people.
Where's Fred now, by the way?
Fred is...
Oh, man, I was going for a definitely dead joke
no,
there.
No, knock on wood, he's not. Never, no. He's not, actually. Bernie, however, is, which is so sad. So now I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, sorry. Thinking, oh, I was like, I just wanted you to go dead and then we'd go.
No,
and
not
then.
Dead. Not dead. But again, another lesson of when you are hesitating with a decision sometimes, you know, you're not sure you should leave one company, go to another. You don't know if working with this person is going to be good. You have to listen to your instincts, you know, and there's nothing wrong with taking a step to do something that you are unsure of. But don't pretend like you weren't sure about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where when you do it and then it goes wrong and you're like, I never should have fucking done that.
Right.
Regret is
that's
a
nasty... every football bet I've ever made.
Oh, well, yeah. That's a whole lot.
God
other story.
Damn it. I knew the Packers.
And by the way, I have not seen that you signed. You haven't signed up for my pools.
No, I was going to talk to you about that after this.
Yeah. So Ruther signed up, for God's sake.
Yeah.
The least you could do is fucking sign up. So,
sorry, was Ruther headlining shows in the Bay Area all weekend? My manager should be aware of this.
I know, you were busy. So the point being, regret is a nasty thing, okay? No decision can be made with certainty because nobody has a crystal ball, right? So you have to at least weigh everything up and then just decide what's best for you in the moment, you know, and let the chips fall where they may. And as things go along, if you see where the pitfalls are going to be or you see where the obstacles are, you can try and fix it. You can try and figure out ways around it to make it better. But in the end, if you knew that certain things may or may not work out, you got to just take it, you know, and move on. But ultimately, you know, it was a difficult process because Fred was facing an industry that wasn't the same as when he had previously produced and he knew everybody. He's someone who deals at the very, very, very top, like the upper echelon chairmen of studios, okay? But chairmen of studios aren't the people running the day-to-day operations.
Right.
So when you had the day-to-day operations people not knowing who Fred Silverman was, and I'd be setting up pitches to go into a network, and I'd say, yeah, so Fred Silverman, we want to come in. We've got some shows to pitch. And I literally had an executive at one of the networks say to me, yeah, can you send me his resume? And it was like, are you nuts right now? And I said to the executive, I said, you know what? I'm not trying to sound like an asshole. I said, but you could put me on hold. Go out your office, go down the hall, go look in the lobby at the wall that has all the old shows on it. That's his resume. And I got this laugh like, oh, that's so funny. And I was like, no, I'm actually dead serious. And you could hear like the typing going on. You know, the person's like looking
Wikipedia.
Him up. Yeah, as we're talking. Oh, that Fred Silverman. Like, no, Freddie B. Silverman.
Yeah.
You know, what the fuck? It's like, come on. So that was a little chat. And I did feel for him in that regard. Because
oh, you said Fred Silverman. I'm sorry. Could have sworn you said Fred Silverman. Such a... My apologies. I have to fix the phone here.
But so, yeah, so that was
still have dial-up.
Challenging, you know, and, but we did a lot of great things. You know, my friend Lindsay, have you met Lindsay?
I don't know.
She was a great coworker. She had actually been working for him for 7 years when I joined, and, God, we had some interesting times, but, we developed a slate of shows, actually sold a couple pilots, and then he just kind of didn't want to do it anymore. It got a little frustrating, and I found myself out of a job, and that was right when the whole market was bad, like in 08, everything mm-hmm. crashed, it was bad. But then I ended up getting a job at MySpace. I was the director of comedy, and it was the whole revamping of it before it ended up getting sold to News Corp. So that was, I think, my most fun gig because it was now in the age of social media. Facebook actually
Tom?
Was just starting. I can't say. I signed an NDA.
I just want to know if the other side of his face is disfigured. That's all I always worry about Tom.
It's pretty funny. It's pretty funny for right now.
Like what? There's a huge right? mole over there.
It is a big one. It's like, you know, there are some people that only take pictures from one side.
Yeah.
And it's like, unless you know them, you're like, but yeah, that was a blast actually. Produced a lot of great content, got some things going there, and then News Corp sold it mm-hmm. and I was out. And then while I was looking for another gig similar to that, because I really liked that business of immediate production and comedy, I met a talent that was unexpectedly someone that I was like, again, I was like, oh, I think I got to work with this person. And I fell back into managing.
Now, when we talked about doing this, you're like, no one wants to listen to me for more than 20 minutes. We're already in over an hour into this.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh
but my God. See how time flies when
I
we're
know,
talking?
But I hope nobody like decided to screw this story.
So now we're going to part two.
Yeah.
The second hour.
Oh, you're, no.
We haven't even gotten to me yet. So I am doing, what's funny is I had just been gone from the country for almost a month. Mm-hmm. And I had done a show at the Parlor in West Hollywood. Right before I left, I called Jay Davis, who used to run a show there.
Love Jay.
And I said to him, I'm going out of town. I'm going to go surf in Costa Rica for 3 weeks. But before I go, I want to book a show for when I get back because I want to have something on the book so that I don't come back and just go like, man, I'm never going back to that life. It's surf wax and coronas for me. And he said, why don't you come by tonight? And I went by that night. I did a spot. And then he said, yeah, come back when you get back into town. And I came back and I went on stage and I did, you know, I thought I did okay. Fine, you know. And when I got off, I was hanging around outside and he said to me, there's a woman here, Randy. She's a manager. She wants to meet you. But he even said right in that first sentence, he goes, just so you know, I don't think she's signing clients. I don't know what her deal is, but she just really liked your set and wants to meet you. So now you fill in the blanks. What? You just go to Jay? You watch the show? What do you see?
Yeah. So funny story, though, is how I ended up there that night was happenstance, too, because I had a client on the show. Who I now no longer represent, by the way. But he was doing that show. And it was like a 10 o'clock at night show. It was a mm-hmm. Monday, right?
Monday.
And I had a super long day and I was going to go, but then I was like, I'm not going to go. And I thought, you know what? I think I'll just go because I wasn't sure where things were at, actually.
And how many
head.
Clients did you have at the time?
Two. And I decided I'm just going to go. Kind of.
So when, by the way, fill in the blanks. When Frank pulled you back in, you picked up a couple other folks.
Yeah.
You lose Frank.
No, I still had Frank at this time. No, wait, did I? I still had Frank at this time. Maybe. You know what? I don't remember.
Actually, I don't think you did.
No, I think no. I think that the Frank thing ended like 3 years ago. So no, I did not. Yeah, but I picked up a couple others. So oh yeah, I had already signed You Suck at Cooking, mm-hmm. my digital creator. Okay, so anyway,
which is a fantastic YouTube channel.
Oh my God, he's great.
That everybody should go and subscribe to.
But again, when I watched his set, I mean, not his set. I watched his YouTube channel. He had 9 episodes. I watched all 9, couldn't shake it. I was like, I gotta know what this is. So again, gut instinct, right? So I go that night to the parlor, kind of didn't want to go, but it's like, I'll go. Go, and I'm sitting at the bar, and, you know, it's, you know, whatever the room was. And then you go on stage, and I saw you walking up, and I was like, well, he's cute. You know, I was first taken by your charming looks. Mm-hmm. Did you have the beard or just the stash?
I must have just had the stash. If not, I might have been fully clean.
No.
I had the stash when I was in Costa Rica, and I either came back and just took it off or still had the stash.
No, you at least had the stash. I think you at least had the stash. Because one of the first things I was talking to you about was going clean shaven.
Right.
So I think you at least had the stash.
Or you know what it was?
You may have had the beard.
I think I was clean. I think I was mostly clean shaven, but then quickly
perhaps
had a beard again. Yeah. Because that's what I took the stash off and then started the process again, perhaps. As I do.
And now we've come to the facial hair of Joe Prano, yes. Part of your podcast.
Well, anybody who's listening, anyway, it's a very simple process. I hate shaving. I grow a beard. I get annoyed with the beard. I go to the mustache. Everybody loves it. It's a fantastic thing. I get compliments on it all the time. And then I take it off just to start the process over.
Grow, shave, repeat.
Yeah. Grow, shave, mustache, fun. Start it over. So I think mustache, I figured, why? I'm in Costa Rica. Let's have a mustache,
of course,
right?
Like, of course.
People will think I'm from here. I think I came back immediately shaved, had the show.
It's possible.
And and so you see me walking up.
So you go up and I was like, because I had also never seen you before. So right. You were a new face too. I was like, I've never seen this guy. And I'm just watching your set and I just loved your material.
What do you think? Would you say there's 100% certainty you had never seen me before?
100% certainty. Yeah.
Not like you were in the improv and you saw it, but it wasn't, and you didn't care, and this, it was different. 100% certain. You're like, who's this guy?
100% certainty. Okay. I'd never seen you before. What is this, a fucking interrogation?
No, because as talent, the reason I ask is for people out there, and as talent, you go like, I'm in the business 18 years doing comedy. I assume everybody's seen me and they don't like me. That's why I'm out here going,
no.
What the fuck am I still doing this for? And the real answer is we're, you know, everybody's just crisscrossing comedy. Like,
yeah, I mean,
because I see comics all the time. I don't know. And I go, maybe I just don't get out enough.
Well, that's part of it too, is now there's these little shows that pop up everywhere too. And it's harder and harder to get stage time at the main clubs. So, you know, comics are doing these shows themselves and, you know, backyard shows and bar shows and what have you. And for the most part, industry isn't exactly going to those scouting talent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, industry doesn't even go out as much as they used to.
Right.
You know, these days it's nearly impossible to get somebody to physically come to the club to watch a set. They're like, just tape it and send it to me.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, for God's sake. So, yeah, I'm 100% sure I had never seen you before. And I was really taken by your material. And I mean, I was out loud laughing, you know, and I just kept thinking to myself, that's a really good bit. Oh, that's a really good bit. And I just felt that there was something about you. It was just everything kind of, for me, came together. And again, you go with your instincts. You know, if you sit and watch enough people and somebody suddenly go, oh, wait, what did that guy say? Then you pay attention. So, yeah, I was not even in the mode of signing. I was, in fact, anti-signing. But I really liked what you had done. And I didn't know about your Dirty Sports podcast then yet. But when I said
I didn't have a manager to tell me to use it as a credit.
That's true. You did not have that as an intro.
I just said, say something nice about me, Jay.
And I think he said, he has a great mustache now. Yeah. But yeah, I said to Jay, I said, because I didn't remember your name, what name he said. So I was like, hey, what was that guy's name? And then I just asked him if you were going to be sticking around. And he said, yeah. He goes, if you want, I'll introduce you. And I was like, yeah. So that's how that happened. And then when we were talking, you know, I could tell that you were suspect. You know, you were a little bit like, yeah, you're a manager. Okay.
Well, Jay had already, told me she's not interested, basically. That And I took that to be like, well, I'm still interested in, you know, meeting people who like me. You know what I mean? I'm always interested in meeting people who like me.
Sure.
Women who like me are always welcome for one drink at least.
That's really
You got
funny.
One drink. What do you get? Who are your references?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were talking then in that other room. And yeah. And then I think I gave you my card and told you we should just talk elsewhere, you know, because my client was still there,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's kind of hard to do that, you know, when you're talking to someone else, because it's like, wait, who are you talking to? Aren't you here for me?
Right.
You know. But yeah. And then when I looked you up, came across Dirty Sports, that was a clincher for me, because as you now know, but story goes, sports has always been a thing for me. When I was at National Lampoon, we developed a sports comedy show with Jim Lampley. That was a pilot for Fox Sports. It never made it, but it was something I always had in me to revive and revamp and do again. And there you are. Great comic, funny stuff, smart, then the Dirty Sports stuff. And that it was more than just managing at that point. It was development with you,
mm-hmm.
and creating a show. Because I had also made a decision that if I was going to manage more people ever, or at this stage of the game, it had to be for bigger development purposes for me, so that I could eventually produce your show and produce content. So that's where that kind of came from as well, especially the sports stuff.
And it's the worst decision you ever made.
And I sit here saying, why, oh, why, oh, why?
And now I'm on your stupid podcast.
No, but you know what? It was one of those things where, again, you say to yourself, this could either really go great or not. But the downside consideration in regard to you was not the same downside in deciding to work, you know, in deciding to work with Fred or in deciding to sign, you know, it's like, there was less of a downside that I saw in regard to you. Because I thought, well, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. You know what I mean? It's like, hopefully it's not going to end up tragic, which but is we also did, why we did, hung out.
We hung out a few times and we got to know each other. And I was like, okay. And then I remember at one point you saying, you know, if I managed you. And then you like stopped yourself. You're like, oh, I don't even know if you're interested. And I'm like, well, I'm not going out to dinner with you every week. It's like... What do you think's happening here, Siegel?
But you know
and
what?
Then I was like, yeah, that's what we're doing, right?
Right, that's what we're talking about. But again, too, for those of your listeners who are performers and always wonder, you know, how do you decide on representation? How do you get somebody? You know, it's better, and I know a lot of talent that has an agent or has a manager that they don't like or doesn't do anything for them. But they figure, well, it's better to have somebody than to have nobody.
Which is exactly the answer for how you know. I think it was a dance where we're both going like, we're trying to figure out what each other are about and try to what could we do together. And I signed with a manager years ago now, and it was the complete opposite. Instead of I'm not really looking to sign people, it's like you're great. I want to sign you. Lunch at the Friars Club in New York. What do you want to do? Letterman? How about a spot on Letterman? Yes, that's what I want. And then everything, and then gone. Sign, paperwork, contract, disappeared. I had more conversations with you in a month before we signed than I did my last manager after the initial two conversations,
right.
Paperwork, gone.
Right.
Hopefully dead.
Need it.
What was there a moment that we've had? I mean, I wouldn't say we together as like a duo have had our ups and downs, but there's certainly better shows, better meetings, worse meetings. Was there a moment where you're like, I don't know, I might have made a mistake with this guy?
Only when you talk about politics. Then I go, what the fuck am I doing with this dude?
Yeah, we definitely disagree on politics.
Oh, Lord.
But we agree on football.
Don't make me think about it too much because I'll be very upset.
Okay, the opposite. Is there a moment, was there on conversation or in a moment where you're like, yeah, I was right. My gut. Anything that stands out is going like, that was a really good joke or a really good. I knew I Knew I had something here.
Every day.
Oh.
Well, that's the truth, though. I know that sounds cheesy and like sappy and shit, but there's not a... You have to understand, every day I'm looking at your stuff online, or I'm listening to your podcast, or I'm figuring out a way to build on something. That's my job. You know, right now, as you know, I'm trying to put together a new tape on you, which you still haven't sent me the file for that sketch you did.
Oh, right. Guy Fieri, if you're listening.
Yeah. What's it called again, the sketch?
That's a great question. I don't know what the final... I think it's Just Call Me Basil.
No,
the
Fix-It guy.
Yeah, yeah.
What's it called?
I forget.
Oh,
what
for
is
sake.
Get It Done.
Yeah, Get It Done.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I need that file.
Yeah.
Get it together. Is yeah. What you really get it.
How come you can't get it done getting me done?
Exactly. But no, I mean, so yeah. So every day when I watch your stuff or listen to something new, which is getting harder and harder to keep up with you, all the stuff that you're pumping out between Dirty Slides and this podcast and Dirty Sports, and you're fucking tweeting sometimes is nerve wracking.
We talked on the last episode about my hashtag unsent tweet of the day. You haven't gotten one of those in a while.
I've on Dirty Sports?
No, on the podcast I did with Lachlan.
Oh, so I only listen to half of that one.
God damn it.
I don't
it
think
is
I
hard
got
to keep
that.
Up. No, I'm just kidding.
And I'm listening to Dirty Sports today from the other day, from yesterday. Yeah, when you guys talk about college ball, I'm like, ugh.
Oh, tell me about it. I'm the same way.
Yeah,
but NFL hasn't started yet.
And can we please have Andy not put his bare feet up in the cameras?
Oh, but you
it
know,
not, I know the
have,
foot fetish yeah. thing. But you know what the opposite of foot fetish is?
People
foot
are grossed
aversion.
Out by feet.
Okay, yeah, it's foot aversion.
Foot aversion.
Which is like, why are you doing that?
I always try to take something from each episode and bold the name of my guest. I think this episode might be Randy Siegel hates feet.
I do, actually. I really do. I do not know.
What's the hardest part about working with me?
The hardest part about working with you is making sure that you are staying on top of developing the stand-up material. Because you don't make adjustments to it as quickly as we talk about you doing. And then you'll say, yeah, well, it's a work in progress. It's been the same work in progress for 3 months. Like, at some point, it has to actually progress.
Right.
Not be a work in. So, yeah, that gets a little frustrating because it's like, oh, this bit was supposed to be ready by now. But that's sometimes I think you either just get like lost with it or you can't figure it out. So you just abandon trying.
Well, there's certainly that. I mean, certainly there's the, but there's also, I think, and I'm not saying that's not the wrong or right or wrong way to do it. It's been a long time since I've been able to sit down and say like, we have an issue with this part. So I shall rewrite this part and then do it. Again, if there's like a line or moment and I'll go, oh, okay, I know that isn't working. So then it can become, and then you go this, but more in like the like sense of like, okay, we got a bit and it's, you know, developing. The way I develop it now is just go up and then try it a different way. Well, what's the different way you're going to try? I don't know. We'll see it when we get up there.
Right. But that's the thing is like the different way then becomes the same way. And I see it the same way a lot. And it's the same way that hasn't progressed.
Right.
That's what I see sometimes. That's frustrating. But I'll tell you this. If you don't freaking do that predator bit with those added lines, you cannot, like, it's such a great bit that you just... We've talked about it. You're asking what frustrates. This is it. That
I don't even remember the lines.
You need to expand on that big time. And every time you'll go up and you'll do it, and I'll be like, he didn't do it again.
Yeah.
And then you're like, damn it, I forgot. Yeah. So stuff like that. But look, if there's anything to say about you, which is, of course, why I'm here, entire first half of this is being cut. And we're just going to be cutting into me praising you. You are extraordinarily focused and hardworking. And that, to me...
Hear that, Mom? She's definitely not an hour and 35 minutes into this.
Oh, dear God. You've got to cut this thing. You have to cut some of this down. 90% of success is doing the work. And I know that there's a lot of people who listen and like, oh, well, I work hard, you know, or I write every day. That's not what it's about. It's about really getting it done. You hustle for yourself. You work, you know, your connections for getting shows that I have nothing to do with. I mean, it's pointless to have a manager calling for a gig that's going to pay you $50. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just off-putting sometimes. Like, oh yeah, now your manager is calling. And it's not the best use of my time, you know, but you work hard and you are constantly developing. You are constantly writing. You're constantly thinking of things. I can't tell you how different that is from a lot of talent that I have done consulting for or spoken to or have represented. That it's like, and what have you done for yourself today? Nothing. What'd you do today? I did blah, blah. Did you write one thing today? Write something. No. And you know, what's interesting about that is the work never stops and it should never stop. So as you know, I've signed David Zucker, the writer, director, legend, as you say,
Writer, director, Airplane, Naked Gun.
Naked Gun.
All the Naked Guns.
Yeah, Scary Movie.
Yeah.
It's a huge thrill to be working with him. I've even had to say to him recently, what did you do today creatively? And he goes, what do you mean creatively? He's like, I was trying to strategize with one of my lawyers. It's like, no. What did you do today that's creative, that's writing? And he was like, I didn't do anything like that. And I said, you every day you have to write. And he didn't quite understand what I was saying, which is fascinating because someone like him, he gets to that point where it's just so much about the business that, oh yeah, I'm a creator. So, you know, he has a couple of scripts. He's actually going to be updating a couple of scripts, you know, that it's like my job though is to help him be in that headspace. It's to help you be in a headspace. It's to kind of know where you're at mentally with things, what your mood is sometimes, you know, and when to maybe tell you something or not tell you something.
Have you ever not told me something because you thought I was in a mood?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes. I have waited on things sometimes.
In person or like we're on the phone and you're like, he's in a mood?
Both.
That's amazing.
Yeah, both. Like I can tell when I hear your voice, like if something's up. Just how it goes, you know.
So now you're working with myself.
Yeah.
David Zucker.
Yes.
How many other clients do you have?
Just one other. You Suck at Cooking.
It's a pretty diverse roster you got there. Digital director that's been in the business. I mean, Airplane came out 40 years ago. And a comedian.
Correct. All of you highly relevant, all of you highly talented, all of you, you know, in my opinion, superstars. I mean, yeah, you're on your way up. David has obviously achieved a certain level of success, but there's a whole nother career for him. I mean, there's more, so much more to him. The scripts that he has right now are Naked Gun 4 is hilarious. Hopefully it'll get made. But, you know, I think that as you're doing stuff, you know, it's eventually about timing. It's eventually about the right people. You know, as we have a showrunner involved now to develop your sports talk show, not moving along as fast as we would like, but I think that that's going to change. It's all about getting the right tape as well. We've been needing new tape. You had some killer sets at the festival, you know, and that's a really good tape that we got.
Now,
and you look good in it.
Just to defend my lack of comedy.
I knew it.
Production.
I knew you've been sitting there dwelling over something.
Yeah,
I could see it in your face that you were
Now that you brought it up, though.
I'm like, something is bugging him. No. And here it is.
No, now that you brought
all
it up, though.
All these great things that I've been saying, you're like, no, let's go back to when you said something about my comedy.
That was a great example because that's one of you talked about the Burbank Comedy Festival. We did a great set. And I always say that now. We did a great set because we did do a great set together.
You did a great set.
But we you said to me, you can't do these, a couple of these jokes that you did when you, we did the festival last year.
Right.
I said, okay, well, I have this other stuff, but it's not ready for that. And in the course of a week, right, we, you get to be part of the bad parts too, ate shit at the improv.
I don't think you ate shit at the
improv. Oh, I mean, that's it. I know people bomb still, but that's eating shit for me.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I mean, and that was a weird night too, though.
I hadn't slept.
Yeah.
There was a lot of...
Oh, yeah, you hadn't slept. You forgot half the lines.
I forgot half the lines.
Oh, that's right.
I forgot half the joke. I forgot some premises. I forgot some punchlines.
Yeah, for jokes that you've been doing, by the way, like, religiously.
But we produced a three-part podcast that then had some technical difficulties the day before.
Sure.
You slept. I didn't sleep.
You think I slept.
Yeah. But then over the course of, that was like a week, basically, from that show, eating shit, forgetting my jokes, to... We did five or six shows between then and the final show of the festival. And I feel like that was a great example of you don't even know your lines. Now you got your lines. Mm-hmm. Now they're funny. Mm-hmm. Now they're funnier. Mm-hmm. Now we get a pretty good tape. I think it's a pretty good tape. I don't think it's like the best tape.
No, it's really good, actually. And, you know, Flappers has been really great to you. And, you know, the fact that they make sure to tape all that stuff and give it to us is awesome. But it's a really good tape, you know? And as any performer out there who's listening knows, it's so hard to get it. And it's hard to sometimes have the club let you tape it or get a copy without charging you $40. It's not easy. It's definitely not easy. And unfortunately, the environment today for bookings and for whether it's club bookings or casting or what have you, you know, it's got to be really impactful in the first 30 seconds. You know, I was at one of the panels that they did for the festival. One of the club bookers literally said, if the first 10 seconds aren't interesting to me, I'm not watching it. It's like, really? Okay. I think that's a little limiting to just
10 seconds.
Say it nicely. Yes. But yeah, I mean, tape is hard to get, good tape, and making sure that it's the right material. But you did a great job with it, so.
When you go out, because we're at comedy clubs a lot, you're obviously watching my set. I imagine, although I pretend probably not, that you're at clubs when you're not with me. You're at comedy clubs doing comedy business. What?
I shall neither confirm nor deny.
Are you still looking for people, or is it the same thing where you're going like, if they jump out at me, then.
Yeah. I mean, my motivating factor is not to sign talent. It's just not. And especially now that I'm working with David as well. Cause you know what? I need to be fair to you and to You Suck at Cooking and to David with where my time is going. I'm a one person operation right now. And you know, who knows, that might change. You know, maybe I'll join a bigger company. Who knows? But in the meantime, my level of work.
Great. Then I have an assistant calling and telling me my material is not coming along fast enough. Even better.
No. No, I'd never let them tell you that.
I like to hear his voice when I tell him.
Exactly. But no, I'm not. But yeah, I mean, look, I'm certainly not going to sit here and say if somebody didn't completely bowl me over, I wouldn't at least investigate. But no, right now, no. Because keep in mind, as a manager, I only get paid when my clients get paid. And a lot of the work that I do is there's no income from it until there's a job. So I can only do so much free work.
Right.
Girlfriend got to pay the rent.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no sugar.
Well, because I do that I do the math all the time. I'm like, I talked to Siegel this much and she gets 10% and 10% of what I was like, what?
Yeah.
She's obviously from money.
So. Which, by the way, not, let's make something clear. Not, no one in the business, family-wise, no nepotism. Nobody helped me up the ladder other than a couple people that, you know, like Bernie, who was a reference for me with Fred Silverman. The no, in fairness, there are people who have been very supportive of me and all that, but the efforts have been, you know, self-made, so to speak.
As a person who grew up, especially, I always say, as a person who grew up as an athlete playing sports, it's like you get a hit, you play, you know, you finish first, you get the blue ribbon, you know, the ball goes in the hoop, it's 2 points. Like, if I make them laugh, then I get to work. And if I don't make them laugh, then I don't get to work. But the reality is, that's not fucking true at all.
Correct.
And that's what I have you for.
Right.
Is, you know, to tell me all the other shit.
Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't matter. And I know that it's hard to, like, wrap your brain around it. It took me a long time to wrap my brain around, too, how it works. But, yes, it is where sometimes the right person who's looking at you on stage doesn't care about the laughs. There's something about you that's right for what they're doing, and they're going to bring you in, or you're going to get cast, or you're going to get used. But for the most part, though, because you are a comedian and because it is the comedy business, funny always wins out. It will always rise to the top. It will always stand out, and it will always be what you have to fall back on. Not funny is not funny. Period. And if you're not funny, you shouldn't be doing stand-up. Now, again, that caveat to that is depending on what you want to get out of it.
Right.
If you don't care, if you're not somebody who has goals of having your own show or getting booked on late night or whatever the goals may be, which, by the way, if you are a performer, whether you're a writer or a stand-up or an actor, you must have goals. You must have an end game. You can't just be like, I just want to be famous. Then go
right.
Be on, you know, Jersey Shore's next family vacation series, you know, which, by the way, I've been watching.
This is the hardest part of working with Randy Siegel.
Can I just tell you, I got hooked on the family vacation round of Jersey Shore. Okay.
Whose families?
It's them.
They're like
their
parents
family.
And shit, or their kids? Well,
yeah, like Snooki and all them. They're parents now, but they still get together. Okay. No. Pauly D and Vinny, I don't even know his last name. These two guys are some of the lines that they come up with are some of the greatest lines that I've ever seen just as people, you know? It is highly entertaining. I've given you a little too much insight as to what I do at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
But that's beside the point.
We're almost at 2 hours now.
You really do have to edit this down.
Now, that's why I feel like I've given you sufficient time to make your case, but you know my goal was Magnum P.I.
I know.
They've cast him. He's Latino, and he does not have a mustache. You're fired.
No, that should save me, because if it had been a straight, white, mustached guy,
right,
and you had never gotten a shot, then you could hang me up. But you met with...
You're rehired.
You met with the CBS team.
Yeah.
You met all the casting people at CBS, and then I told them that you were interested in it. And clearly, it went a completely opposite direction.
They cast a chihuahua.
So wait, is that... I know, right? Is that harder for you... Is it easier for you to see, or is it harder for you to see?
What do you mean?
Like when they make a decision like that in a role that you wanted. Or at least that you wanted a crack at.
It's certainly... I don't know. I think it's equal parts, because in one way, it's like... It's harder because... You're going like, what the fuck? Like how, like it's harder. It's just harder to deal with like, who's doing this? Who's in charge? Like, I get it. Tom Selleck has a mustache, but, and Magnum maybe doesn't have, like, whatever this fucking decision is, like, but Magnum doesn't have to have a mustache. And I'm going, well, Tom Selleck's from Michigan. That's why he's wearing a fucking Tigers hat. He's got a Tigers hat on the billboard. Why is he still a fucking Tigers fan? Selleck was a Tigers fan, not Mag. Like, you guys are so fucking confused.
Right.
It just makes me want to go, like, what the fuck? Like, I wish I could have been able to be there and say, this is why the show's going to get canceled.
Well, look, and
maybe it won't.
Who knows?
Maybe it'll be on for 50 years, like Hawaii 5-0.
But that's what's happened is we no longer have predictability. You know, stuff that we think is going to make it gets canceled right away. And other stuff, you're like, how is this even on anymore?
Right.
You know? But
then it's easier because you're just like, well, I guess they wanted to go a different way.
Right. So, I mean, that's my question. So, I guess it makes you feel a little better. It was so drastically different.
And it's certainly better than, like, they choose somebody else. Like, it's also easier when they go, like, yeah, we cast you know, like, I remember when Bob Barker left, I was like, ooh, Price is Right would be a good gig, right? But, like, Bob Barker wasn't, he was just a guy who did Price is Right for 50 years. And then they're like, we're going to cast, it was, they were talking about, like, Rosie or, like, it's like, oh, well, if they already cast somebody that's famous, then there you go.
Right, right.
Now, you always hear the story of, we found the guy that, you know, it came out of nowhere and just blew us away. Like, which I would feel like, hey, first,
why can't I be that guy?
If we go to, if we're just having auditions and Magnum PI happens, like, we're all sitting, you know, you often show up to an audition and you kind of look like everybody, but it's like, come on, like,
right. That's when you hope that your manager has a Me Too moment she could hold over someone's head.
But that's where it's like, I hope I get to sit down with a bunch of other people that want Magnum, because it's like,
right. But you know what? That's a perfect example of some stuff where I hesitate sometimes to send you articles about things.
Yeah.
If I know that you're in a bad mood or
if
something.
If I'm triggered.
Yeah. Yeah. Like when the Magnum stuff came out, like I intentionally didn't send you a couple of articles because I knew how much into that. Yeah, and I was like, yeah. And then there was something that you were kind of upset with one day. And I was like, I'm not going to send this to him today. Because that's one of the things I do. I send you articles all the time so that you're kind of up on things that are happening and all that. But like, I definitely have hesitated to send you things at certain times. Yeah. Yeah. But other times,
he's got to see this. Other times, but that's, it's good for the fans of other stuff. You're like, oh, you guys want No Chill? Here you go. I'll send them that they've decided that Magnum P.I. is a Latino woman.
I actually thought that that would make you feel better.
Yeah.
You know? Because it was like, well, it wasn't even close to you. I mean, yeah, and that, believe me, that's hard for me too. Like when I'm trying and I get no traction whatsoever and I sit there and I think, oh my God, let it be somebody who's Asian.
Well, Siegel, thank you for sitting here for over two hours.
Prano, you're going to edit this down.
Oh, yeah. We'll edit it down.
Yeah, you must.
So, again, where do people send you their unsolicited?
Nowhere. Because I do not accept unsolicited material. And by the way, for those of you out there that always remember, well, how's anyone supposed to get my script? Bottom line is this. There's a reason for the unsolicited thing, because people have scripts in development. They have ideas. There absolutely could be something similar to yours. And if they didn't ask you for it, then they could say, well, I never asked you for it. I already had it. You're going to claim it was ripped off. But the best way to do something, if you're going to communicate with somebody, write them and ask, can I send you a project? Do not say the plot line. Do not say what it's about. Just say, I have a pilot that is in this arena. Can I send it to you? Don't send an entire summary and all of the whole shebang in an email, because now you're giving it away too. Why would you give away your ideas? Your ideas are the only thing that you have. Hold on to them as close as you can and ask permission. If somebody says, yes, send it to me, then you have a trail, you have them requesting it, and it's much better in the end for you. Why are you laughing at me? You're like on the verge of cracking up.
No, because I have a script I'm ready to pitch you right now.
Right now? Well, yeah. I'm your manager. You can tell me anything.
No, but I think it'll be good for people to hear it. It's a comic.
Oh, wait. That's right. There's other people listening.
And his manager. But they abandoned the business to fight crime.
Oh, my God. What kind of crime?
Mostly sex crimes.
It's like social injustice.
Yeah, it's like Law and Order. It's like Law and Order SVU. It's like Law and Order SVU.
Did you hear, by the way?
It's a lot of like dead bodies. Like, that's what she said jokes, you know?
There's a new Law and Order.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's Law and Order hate crimes.
No.
Hand to God. Just was announced today. You know the old.
I'm just going to hit stop. Or just stop.
Do you know the old joke about like Law and Order meter maid version?
Yeah.
Law and Order hate crimes. Just announced today.
Wow. Dick Wolf does it again.
Right? It's nonstop. It's total nonstop.
Well, anyway, I got to go watch that.
Unlawful Disorder is your series.
Unlawful Disorder. Well, that's it, Siegel. Any parting words? This is often where people get to plug their social media or talk about the projects.
JoePrano.com. At Fix Your Life on Twitter, which we still have to figure out how to get that fixed. At Fix Your Life, DirtySports.com, JPP. You don't have a separate website, though, for that.
No.
Facebook, you don't like, but it's Joe Prano Comedy.
Yep.
go to your website to check your shows, where you're going to be performing around town. What else about you?
I'll be in Chicago this weekend.
Oh, yeah. You're headlining in Chicago this weekend. You're also doing a Dirty Sports episode with Andy Ruther.
That's yesterday.
Yeah. Huh?
That comes out. This will come out after that.
Oh.
But good job. You're on it so far.
Okay. Well, I'm on it. yeah. But yeah, got to listen to Dirty Sports. Because God knows what's going to happen on that. What rant will take place. So that's what I'm plugging. I could plug You Suck at Cooking, right?
Yes.
You don't mind.
No. Plug all of...
You Suck at Cooking on YouTube. And David Zucker. I mean, he's just David Zucker. He's awesome. He's the legend. But yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Randy.
Joe Prano.
Hey, Joe, I like Joe's show. I tell everybody that's my shit. See, I had a long ride, turned the volume up high, and the time flew by so quick. I laughed out loud, that's what it's about. I really don't feel safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause he drinks till he hits the flow. Hey, Joe, it's time to stop the show. Pack it up and away we go. Donate.